Okay, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. So, the shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. Page 269 in my book, but of course you have a different... Do you have a different...
No? 269 in your two.
Oh, there you go.
You have the same criteria. No, you don't.
All right.
We are not alone.
You got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that is sneaky. What book is that?
It's, the middle way.
Yeah.
So just the English and then the Polytechnic.
It's the Polytech Society.
Yeah.
And who did the translation?
1987, I.B. Horner.
Yeah.
Is that the same translation?
No, it's a different translation, but that'll be really interesting.
Yeah,
that's one of the old ones that I used to have.
Oh,
yeah. Beautiful. Where'd you get it?
The first time I spent some time at the Dharma Center, Rinpoche was going through some of these.
Right, so you got it there?
Way back,
yeah. Low these many years ago.
Karen Nesselup got these.
Yeah. So this is a new translation that we're using.
Okay, and who translated it?
This is by Nyanamoli, and then Bhikkhu Bodhi went through it and... updated some of Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's teaching. So they're both quite well-known translators and things. And so this is a newer edition. So it'll be interesting for you to see the difference between... Because that one was done... When was that translated? Probably...
Since 87 or 88.
Yeah, but the first translation was probably in the 60s or...
First published 54.
Yeah. There'll be slightly different words and things, you know, because that was the English people, and this is getting more toward North American and more updated language, so it'll be fun. Anything that really strikes you, do let us know.
Okay.
So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. I wonder why they've got that first thus have I heard footnoted. Let's take a look. According to the chronicles of Sri Lanka, this was the first sutta preached by Mahinda Thera following his arrival in Sri Lanka. So this was the first Buddhist teaching that reached Sri Lanka. I like these little history notes. Now on that occasion, the Brahmin, Janusoni, was driving out of Sawati in the middle of the day in an all-white chariot drawn by white mares. He saw the wanderer Pilotika coming in the distance and asked him, "Now, where is Master Vachaya coming from in the middle of the day?" You're going to tell us what Vichaya means. Vichaya is Pilotika's clan name. "Sir, I am coming from the presence of the recluse, Gotama. What does Master Vachayana think of the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom? He is wise, is he not?" "Sir, who am I to know the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom? One would surely have to be his equal to know the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom." I love that.
It's an interesting answer.
It's so Buddhist. That's what they say, like you can't tell who is a Buddha unless you're a Buddha.
That's
one of the rules in Buddhism, never to discuss whether somebody is enlightened or not, because it's a useless question unless you're enlightened, and if you're enlightened, you don't care. Interesting, eh? That one seems to have gotten lost along the way every once in a while, I think. You know, many people love to talk about who's enlightened and who isn't. Have you ever noticed that? After retreats, a lot of people like to talk, come and talk about who awakened and who didn't. And how many brownie points we all got. Master Vachayana, Vachayana, praises the recluse Gotama with high praise indeed. Sir, who am I to praise the recluse Gotama? The recluse Gotama is praised by the praised as best among gods and humans. What reason does Master Vachayana see that he has such confidence in the recluse Gotama? Sir, suppose a wise elephant woodsman were to enter an elephant wood or were to see in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across. He would come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. So too, when I saw four footprints of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing in a good way, practicing the good way. What are the four? Sir, I have seen here certain learned nobles who were clever, knowledgeable about the doctrines of others, as sharp as hair-splitting marksmen. I love that. Hair-splitting marksmen. They wander about, as it were, demolishing the views of others with their sharp wits. Is there a big difference in the translation, Heather?
On some
here and
parts,
there?
Yeah.
Yeah. When they hear, oh, the recluse Gotama will visit such and such a village or town, they formulate a question thus, we will go to the recluse Gotama and ask him this question. If he is asked like this, he will answer like this. And so we will refute his doctrine in this way. And if he is asked like that, he will answer like that. And so we'll refute his doctrine in that way. They hear, the recluse Gotama has come to visit such and such a village or town. They go to the recluse Gotama, and the recluse Gotama instructs, urges, rouses, and encourages them with a talk on the Dhamma. After they have been instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged by the recluse Gotama with a talk on the Dhamma, they do not so much as ask him the question. So how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they become his disciples. When I saw this first footprint of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Again, I have seen certain learned Brahmins who were clever. And the same thing, they were going to go and ask this question or that question. Right? The first one was, as you know, certain learned nobles and then certain Brahmins. In actual fact, they too became his disciples. When I saw this second footprint of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened. Again, I have seen certain learned householders who were clever, and the same thing happens to them. In the fourth footprint, again, I have seen certain learned recluses who were clever. They do not so much as ask him the question, so how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they asked the recluse Gotama to allow them to go forth from the home life into homelessness, and he gives them the going forth. Not long after they have gone forth, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. They say thus, we were very nearly lost. We were very nearly perished. For formerly we claimed that we were recluses, though we were not really recluses. We claimed that we were Brahmins, though we were not really Brahmins. We claimed that we were Arahants, though we were not really Arahants. But now we are recluses. Now we are Brahmins. Now we are Arahants. When I saw this fourth footprint of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened. So forth. Dharma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. When I saw these four footprints of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. When this was said, the Brahma Janusoni got down from his all-white chariot drawn by white mares, and arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he extended his hands in reverential salutation toward the Blessed One, and uttered this exclamation three times, honor to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Honor to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Honor to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Perhaps sometime or other we might meet Master Gotama and have some conversation with him. Then the Brahmin Janusoni went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and related the Blessed One his entire conversation with the wanderer Pilotika. Thereupon the Blessed One told him, at this point, Brahman, the simile of the elephant's footprint has not yet been completed in detail. As to how it is completed in detail, listen and attend carefully to what I shall say. Yes, sir, the Brahman Janusoni replied. The Blessed One said this, Brahman, suppose an elephant woodsman were to enter an elephant wood and were to see in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across. A wise elephant foot woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are small she-elephants that leave a big footprint, and this might have been one of their footprints. He follows it and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, and some scrapings high up. A wise elephant woodman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are tall she-elephants that have prominent teeth and leave a big footprint, and this might have been one of their footprints. He follows it further and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint long in extent and broad across and some scrapings high up and marks made by tusks. A wise elephant woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are tall she-elephants that have tusks and leave a big footprint, and this might be one of their footprints. He follows it further and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint long in extent and broad across and some scrapings high up and marks made by tusks and broken off branches. And he sees that bull elephant at the root of a tree or in the open, walking about, sitting or lying down. He comes to the conclusion, this is that big bull elephant. Which is definitely one of the other great rules in Buddhism, to be seen for oneself. The whole thing of like doing the right thing is like just taken right out of Buddhism. It's like to see for yourself, to trust your own morality, to trust your right to have a question, and then to see what the answer to your question is for yourself, not to hope you got the right answer. You know, and that's a big, you know, that means that there is no authority but your own being. And that makes some of us a little time, every once in a while, a little uncomfortable, doesn't it? If we're honest.
Mm-hmm.
If we're honest about that, doesn't it? So really, you know, it's a training to be get to the point where you see for yourself. And that's what he's saying, you know. This is like such a profound teaching, to see for oneself, because you can have the way pointed to you, but you don't want to do it because it's been pointed to you. You want to do it because you want to see for yourself. There is no other reason to follow a path. Is there? Otherwise, when you hit a moment of unsureness or despair, which always comes just before you learn something new, right? First relinquishment and then realization, right? Right? Otherwise, when you hit that relinquishment, that letting go of something precious to you, you're going to blame somebody else and look for another right answer. So you just go round and round and round in the same story over and over again, don't you? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Did you just say that again? You said something about just before you make a breakthrough, you feel discouraged or something?
Yeah, you have a sense of like there's something you have to let go. There's a relinquishment, something you have to be precious that you have to let go of. But no new realization comes unless you're open, right?
Because when the new realization comes, then it's, you've had to let go of something to be able to understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. No realization comes without relinquishment.
Mm-hmm.
So to see for yourself, in order to have the courage to see for yourself, you have to not be checking something out because somebody else told you it was the right answer. It has to be your own desire to know if it's the right answer. Because if it comes to that point where it's a little iffy, you might have to give something precious. You'll blame the other, won't you?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we do?
Mm-hmm.
Grasp onto our safety, don't we? Rather than admit I'm scared and I really want to know this. So I am willing to take just one more step. Just one more step. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So this is like really, to me, bringing this teaching of the Buddhist tradition. It's not faith and then moving. It's the question, the faith that you have the right to ask the question. Use all your intelligence as much as you're able to check out the way, and then you walk it alone to see for oneself. I think that is the only thing that is trustworthy. And that's one of the most profound things we have as a human being, the right to do something, to know for ourselves. Even with somebody around like me who always loves telling everybody what to do. It's really nice for you to say, okay, thanks, I said, shut up, I gotta see for myself. Isn't it? Isn't that important? Then we're together, aren't we? We're like working together. Because I promise I'll do that. You promise you'll do that. So you're not putting the responsibility on somebody else, just, you know? You're actually accepting your own birthright to see for oneself. You're actually making your life precious to see for oneself. So I really like that point, as I said. I thought I'd bring it out even more clearly. This is that big bull elephant. See, it's for oneself. So too, Brahman, here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmins, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dharma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. A householder or householder's son or one born in some other clan hears that Dharma. On hearing the Dharma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. Possessing that faith, he considers thus, household life is crowded and dusty. I like that. Of course, in India, it's even more so. But my basement's pretty good, too. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune, abandoning a small or a large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home into the homelessness. Having thus gone forth, and possessing the bhikkhu's training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly. He abides compassionate to all living beings. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, he abstains from taking what is not given, taking only what is given, expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity. Abandoning in celibacy, he observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. Abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these, nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. Abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. Abandoning gossip, he abstains from gossip. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and the discipline. At the right time, he speaks such words as are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. He abstains from injuring seeds and plants. He practices eating only in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time. Footnote probably relating to eating in one meal, or the ekabatika means it's when you're eka is one, so it's like one meal a day basically, and in accordance with the commentarial explanation is eating only in the forenoon. According to the Vinaya, the proper time for bhikkhus to eat is between dawn and noon. From noon until the next dawn, only liquids are allowed. And in the monasteries, most of the monasteries I stayed at, there was like one or two that were different. One could have something small to eat upon waking up, and then the main meal was around, at about 11:15. And then that was all. You could drink whatever you wanted, like coffee or tea or things all afternoon, but you didn't eat again until the next day. Some Achan Cha, I believe, his monastery, people there mostly only ate one meal, period, around 10:30. But it varied. In a climate where you don't have, the heat and the, that there is in the south, you need more than one meal, so that's changed somewhat. Although some people in the north do eat more than one meal. The idea is to eat as much as you need to maintain your health, but no more. So sometimes somebody would get sick and the doctor would say, oh, you have to eat a little more, So that was considered food, it was considered medicine. Okay, he abstains from wearing garlands, so this is like the paramis and the rules for novice, not eating in the right time and so forth. It's like like the rules for being ordained, basically running through the basic rules. He practices eating only when he abstains from dancing, singing, music, and theatrical shows. He abstains from wearing garlands, smartening himself with scent, embellishing himself with unguents. He abstains from high and large couches. He abstains from accepting gold and silver. He abstains from accepting raw grain. He abstains from accepting raw meat. He abstains from accepting women and girls. He abstains from accepting men and women slaves. He abstains from accepting goats and sheep. He abstains from accepting fowls and pigs. He abstains from accepting elephants, cattle, horse, and mares. He abstains from accepting fields and land. He abstains from going on errands and running messages. He abstains from buying and selling. He abstains from false weights, false metals, and false measures. He abstains from cheating, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery. He abstains from wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunder, and violence. He becomes content with robes to protect his body. So anything that would create any kind of self-clinging, do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Anything that would make a sense of I should be looking out for myself. Anything that turned the mind from may all beings be happy. That's all of those rules they apply to. It's an interesting concept, isn't it?
Yeah.
To train your mind to move past the fear that causes us to grasp after a self. Whatever position, you know how many times in your day you try to protect yourself by being right or being good or how many times? And imagine that you took a vow to not do that because you knew that the self is anicca dukkha anatta. What does that mean? What does anicca mean? Dukkha, what does that mean? Dissatisfactory, basically. You notice that whenever there's a self, there's something that isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else always has a nicer blouse or a better vest fit or sits more comfortably in their chair or travels more or is just downright more charming or, there's always something. Isn't that true? Is it true or not?
Yes.
So whenever you try to protect a self, it's not leading to wisdom. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. There is no inherent identity. It doesn't exist. Whatever is coming into being based on conditions is dissolving, because conditions are always changing. And is suffering. Whenever there is form, it's suffering because something's left out. Okay? So when you actually accept that and you decide you want to find out something that's actually true, that actually is trustworthy, that is it possible to see for oneself a path that is beyond anicca dukkha anatta, you'd have to take a few vows, wouldn't you? You'd have to sit down and figure it out. Okay, what don't I want to do? Because how many ways, we sneakily just, I'm doing this for... Does this give you a different sense of what the rules were about?
Yes.
Yeah, I wondered where those came from.
They came slowly, and if you actually... I don't know if I have it anymore. I used to have a copy of the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the rules. In every rule, there's a story about why it came into being.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one time, the Buddha was staying here, and these guys got all together, and they were thinking, every time we go to town, we don't get any mangoes, and even if Bhikkhu, who's at Wachami, is behind us, one second after we pass by the street, his bowl is full of mangoes as he's walking by. And how come that's happening? So they started wondering about that, so then they figure out that he's walking along saying, oh, I had this wonderful experience where I learned to foretell the proper winning number for lotteries, and I was under the impression that whoever gave me the most mangoes, that's who I should give the number to. He's like musing aloud as he walks down the street, so everybody's piling mangoes into his bowl, right? I'm updating the story a little, but this is basically what happened. So they're like, the other bookers are going, and then finally one of them goes and says, you know, Lord Buddha, da-da-da-da, is and the Buddha calls all the monks together and he says to them, you know, come here, and like, I got news for you. He didn't say that that wasn't right or wrong. He didn't say that whether that person really knew the winning lottery ticket or didn't. He didn't go into prophecy at all. He said, it is against the rule. If you are going to follow this practice, you cannot talk about your meditation experience, especially to people who aren't doing that meditation. It is like right across the board. No. And you run into that rule a little bit, you know, here and there amongst people, I'm sure. So every one of the rules that are written, there's a story about how they came into being. And it's really, you know, I should get another copy of it. It's really worth reading. It really gives some flesh and blood to all those rules. They're not just weird.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
I have a question. I find it a bit confusing
what kind of tea is this?
Is it strong?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's not putting yourself first or how it is, but like, that doesn't mean that you need to look after your health, say, for example.
Absolutely.
Like, you need property and things like that.
Absolutely. And so it isn't a matter of like having like there are people who make a very powerful self-grasping out of never wanting anything, aren't there? Oh no, I'm fine. You go ahead. I'll be fine.
Like being a martyr.
Yeah. It's like what they're talking about here is to have a desire to understand other than the self what is there. Is it possible, what is consciousness without a self? Is it possible to have an experience of consciousness without a self? What would that be? Very much like Meister Eckhart, God has left a small point between thee and he. You know, that was one of Eckhart's saying, and I think it was Meister Eckhart. I'm not sure, but I think it was. And that whole sense of turning around to find that bridge between consciousness within what seems like an individual and what is the bridge to universal consciousness? Is there one? You know? They call it in Buddhism turning around in the seat of consciousness. To turn around and see that small point rather than to look out and keep defending the borders or trying to find love or... Do you understand?
Well, I'm getting a...
So that in order to be able to do that, you have to let go of not valuing the self. You don't let go of it because the self is what you're going to use to find that small point. But not to indulge self as being more important than any other self.
Mm-hmm.
Not to indulge self-clinging or self-grasping. So, of course, if you need to eat, you eat. And of course, you know, there are all these kinds of things, these stories about monks who decided that they were not, now they had some experience and they were not going to move until they understood something to be seen for themselves, until they moved into that turning about in the seat of consciousness. But they didn't go to that point, that's called adetana or determination, to actually just stay on that point and try to find, you know, where is that bridge to totality beyond self? Where is consciousness beyond self, right?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't go to that point until they were sure that if they held their mind in one place, they didn't, that's not something that you do just on your first, 3 month retreat. You learn how to practice kindness with your body. So it requires this honesty, which is to be seen for oneself.
So that's what you mean when you say bring all parts of myself to the cushion with me when I'm meditating.
Yeah.
That's being honest.
Yeah.
Trying to see that.
Not just the holy parts.
Mm-hmm.
Boring, aren't they? Because there'll always be something that will cause one of them to, leave the room, and they'll be replaced by a devil,
Mm-hmm.
Like a neighbor will talk too loud or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true? You're sitting there being really holy, and then suddenly your holiness just suddenly disappears, and suddenly this demonic being is there because you remembered something somebody said to you at grade six or something. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
So, like, you stay there and have as many cushions as you need for everybody else. You keep your focus. Because you're the leader. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Any other?
Okay.
No, I'm fine. Please don't do that. Thank you.
I got one.
How's that?
Iced tea.
So where were we? So possessing, right? He becomes content with robes to protect his body, with alms food to maintain his stomach. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want fashions. It's already been taught how you get your robes, so that's already set up. Or people give you robes, but it has to be freely given. Little hooks in it, And with alms food to maintain his stomach, and wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Whenever you go anywhere, you're allowed to take an extra set of robes sometimes, but not usually. Robes, umbrella, a bowl, and I've forgotten the other thing. Do you know? Some kind of hygiene thing, like, I can't remember what it is, a toothstick or something like that. Those are your possessions. If you need medicine, you're allowed to take that. But that's how you go wandering. And the umbrella, it sometimes has a mosquito net thing in it. You set it up in the forest and you put the net around you, Sometimes it doesn't. So those are the things that it's all right to give to a monk on the full moon day, Vesak day. Those are called the four requisites. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden. Isn't that a lovely line? So too, the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect his body, with alms food to maintain his stomach, and wherever he goes, he sets out taking only those with him. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. So you can imagine how much your thought process would be cut right out if that's all you were going to do. No phone calls to return. Can you imagine what that would do to your mind? No other thing to concern yourself with. Just take your robes and your alms bowl and go walking.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever you were, it was home.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Very different, huh? Basically incomprehensible, really. So he experiences with himself a bliss that is blameless because there's nothing he should do or ought to do or didn't do or... Do you understand that? Only with what is freely given, that's all. No debts.
Mm-hmm.
How amazing.
Mm-hmm.
On seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Because there's nothing he needs or nothing he wants. He likes his own haircut. Neat, eh? Since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, there are the habits of a lifetime that are going to go, oh, look at those earrings. I wonder where she got them. Ooh. You know? The habits of a lifetime, right? He doesn't leave his eyes unguarded. Evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him, right? He wants to keep the mind clear, trying to see anicca, dukkha, anatta, and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for that beyond point. He practices the way of restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. Let's see what they say about that. 322. This formula is analyzed at Visuddhi Magga 153-59. Briefly, the signs nimitta are the most distinctive qualities of the object. So when you're looking at an object, your mind, the perception that your mind will bring up is not actually the outer object, but it will be the perceptions that you have stored of it, the movie. And it will be the most distinctive qualities of the object, which when grasped at unmindfully can kindle greed, hatred, and delusion, right? Oh, gee, that reminds me of my Aunt Nellie. Yeah, I wonder where my Aunt Nellie went. Yeah, she went out and rode away with that guy that came out of the East with silver bullets and a gray horse. And where did they go? Oh, yeah, I think Aunt Marion got a postcard. I wonder where Aunt Marion is now. You know? Patoing. Is that true?
Yeah.
So then it's all I, and me and my relations, subject, object. When there's no object, who is the subject? Isn't going to come up easily with that, is it? Can kindle defiled thoughts. The features, anubhyanjana, are the details that may subsequently catch the attention when the first perceptual contact that has not been followed up by restraint. So that's basically what I was saying. States of covetousness and grief signifies the alternative reactions of desire and aversion, attraction and repulsion towards sense objects. We're all familiar with that. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Since if he left the mind faculty unguarded, evil and unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the mind faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the mind faculty. Possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, he experiences within himself a bliss that is unsullied. You just bring your mind into the here and now. called jhana. He becomes one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Wouldn't that be refreshing? Who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs? Who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl? Who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting? Who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating? Who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent? Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue and this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. On returning from his alms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. 323. Covetousness, abhijaya, abhijha, here is synonymous with sensual desire, kamachanda, the first of the five hindrances. Remember the five hindrances? It was a while ago, but you must maybe vague idea of them.
Can you
see them? He's going to just do them all here, so okay. That will be, I'm sure. Abandoning ill will. So the first one is the desire for an experience other than that which is present. Right? Abandoning ill will and hatred. He abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, because after you have a little ill will, then you get exhausted, right? Don't you? You go into a slump, don't you? Pretty well. Basic, isn't it? First you get pissed off and then you go into depression, isn't that how it was? Use all that energy and then you the balloon collapses. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware, he purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, because then that's the next thing, isn't it? Suddenly then you start making rules again, don't you? He abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt. And then finally, if you don't go through the cycle again, you say, oh, it's no use. This is impossible. I can't do it. It's stupid. Right? Buddhist idea is just purely stupid. It's just, you know, show me somebody who really knows what they're talking about with this stuff. It's just an idea, right? Mm-hmm. Don't we do doubt well? Mm-hmm. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt and perplexed about wholesome states. I love that. He knows what wholesome states are. Because doubt, you're not sure what wholesome states are. I love that line. Mm-hmm. Unperplexed about wholesome states, you know, where you just kind of let the line get a little soft there. Not sure where the edge is. Oh, I guess I shouldn't have done that. Oops. Unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances or imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, first level of absorption, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought. Right? First, the mind keeps coming back, applied. You keep applying your mind back to the main object without getting angry, right? Just like the breath, okay, and then your mind wanders, you keep bringing it back. And then when it's sustained, you know that it's sustained. And then when it wanders again, you know it, and you keep bringing it back. Applied and sustained thought. Is that clear? With rapture, and pretty soon you start feeling calmer and a little bit happy about that. You're not really sure why, but there's this kind of slight sense of happiness there. Pleasure born of seclusion. This Brahman is called a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. No, 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 it doesn't get there yet. But we do have a footnote, 324. He does not come to this conclusion about the triple gem, because the jhanas and the mundane direct knowledges are held in common with those outside of the Buddha's teaching. This is a teaching that's common to many schools of meditation and Buddhism. This is not yet what the Buddha is teaching. It is what the Buddha teaches, but there's further to go. Again, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana. This means you don't have to bring your mind back or be aware of it. You're just like wherever you put your mind, there is focus. That's fun. Like when you really love music, or you really enjoy light, or you're really enjoying a poem or something, there's just that moment of just really totally being there, and your mind wouldn't wander no matter what. Watching a child playing, or, you know, so many times, like just that. And then the next moment, huh? Enters upon and abides in a second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind. Because when you have that kind of, just without bringing your mind back, there is self-confidence. You let go of thinking you should be somewhere else, don't you? You're just absorbed in what you're looking at or feeling. Or that's self-confidence, isn't it? And singleness of mind without applied sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully enlightened. Again, with the fading away as well of rapture, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body. He enters on and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. This too, a Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened. Again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, and so forth. When his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. He recollects his manifold past lives, that is, one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. Now, how about that for an amazing idea? But just following cause and effect back. How many, you know, which mother, which father, which lifetime, you know? Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects his manifold past lives. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened. When his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human. Isn't that interesting? The divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human. He sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. He understands how beings pass on according to their actions. Thus with this divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And he understands how beings pass on according to their actions. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened. When his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. So now he knows the mind. That is wholesome. He knows the mind that has the power of concentration. He knows the truth of nothing arises without cause. He knows the truth of whatever is causal is impermanent. Right? From what we've talked about so far.
Mm-hmm.
He knows there isn't an inherent self there. Right? Because he had the experience of jhana where there is no self. No experience of self. It's equanimity. No subject object. Right? When his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. So then he turns around and looks at the experience and says, he understands that it actually is, this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the taints. This is the origin of the taints. This is the cessation of the taints. This is the way leading to the cessation of the taints. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple still has not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Rather, he is in the process of coming to this conclusion. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. This holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming into any state of being. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. It is at this point that a noble disciple has come to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. This shows the occasion when the disciple has attained the fruit of arahatship and having completed all his tasks in every way, has come to the conclusion about the Triple Gem. And it is at this point, Brahman, that the simile of the elephant's footprint has been completed in detail. When this was said, the Brahman Janu Soni said to the Blessed One, magnificent Master Gautama. Master Gautama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those whose eyes, with eyes to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of the Bhikkhus. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Any questions? Answers? Comments? Thanks. Specific, my dear friend?
Well, like going to a stripping, sort of that part of stripping down one's life to aim at clarity, to going to a hut or and just having the robes and following those rules.
Okay, I see, yeah.
Yeah.
But so, can you go back to verse 12, my dear? So, 272 in my page. Have you got? You know, he's the Buddha has just talked about the fourth step of seeing the big bull elephant, and then there's the next verse that goes so too Brahman here. Do you want me to find it in your book, or do you want? Can I see your book, please? Can be either from 223 to the top of 224.
Okay, thank you.
So let's start 223. So too, which is chapter 11 in our books, so too Brahman here at Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. Does that sound familiar, Heather?
It does.
Why is it familiar? Any idea?
That's the Heart Sutra?
No. Itipi so bhagava raham sama sambuddho vijacharana sampano sugato lokavitu anuttaro purisa dhammasarati sata Deva Madhusanam Buddho Bhagavati. Iti Piso. Such indeed is Bhagava. It's the Blessed One. Arahant. Here at Tathagata appears in the world accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, Deva Manusanam.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's the salutation to the Buddha.
Yes.
You all heard it with Sayadaw Tilawanta when he was here. You've heard it from a lot of people. Right? That's what it is. Okay. So that's what a Tathagata comes, and his dispensation lasts for a couple thousand years, 2,000-3,000 years. Is that interesting? He declares his words with his gods and Maras, its Brahmins, its generation, with its recluse and Brahmins, its princes, its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He declares what this world is with all of its different types of beings. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. With the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. So that's like set up. Okay, we're still in that dispensation because we can read this book.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay, next. A householder or householder's son or daughter, or one born in some other clan, in some other place, in some other country, here's that Dharma. That's us, isn't it? On hearing the Dharma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. That's what we're working on. Would you say that's true?
Yeah.
Have you acquired faith in the Tathagata fully yet? Fully?
Yeah.
Okay. Possessing that faith, so you're not quite in, you haven't paid off the full mortgage yet. Okay. So, but you're working on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's worth exploring to you.
Yeah.
But when you possess that faith, when the mortgage is paid, what does it say? He considers us. What does it say? I can't hear you.
The household life is confined and dusty.
Right. Okay. I now have faith. I want only to practice. I don't want friends. I don't want... That's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
This is not my language. This is... So, if you do that without faith, what happens? You start getting caught up in the same things you get caught up. You make the householder's life into the monastery.
Oh.
Or the forest. Start being pissed off at those bees and these birds. Or why didn't people come and give me, why haven't I got new, oh, they got nicer robes than me, I should be over there, right?
Mm.
Because your faith is not beyond being concerned about self. There is still this feeling that there's something right you should be doing to get a reward. You're not saying, no matter what right I do, rewards come and go. What is beyond good and bad? What transcends duality? Right? You need a very clear kind of faith to do that. So there is this period of building up the faith where one has to meet circumstances where you get to look at your own sense of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It's true, isn't it? We do have a certain sense of judgment, don't
mm-hmm.
we? Ourself and others, don't we? Rather than compassion, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that once or twice in myself today. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Does this make sense?
Yeah.
So once you have that faith, and you think you have the power to hold it most of the time, and you want to hold it. You have faith in your faith. Go for it.
Oh, I'm thank you. That really clarified.
Yeah.
Because I was that quite
nervous. It's right there,
it's,
too, eh?
It is.
Neat, eh?
Yeah, thank you.
There's like very definite stages.
Mm.
First, you have to develop the faith. And you know yourself that your faith is just deepening right now, isn't it?
Yeah. It is, yeah.
So what your question is really is not should I go off to a monastery, but is am I developing faith where I am? Is there a better way to develop faith?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a different question.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to develop faith if I go somewhere else, or am I going to develop clinging?
Oops. Yeah.
You know, some people, they call faith, they call it, what they really call faith is actually comfort. Nothing's disturbing them, therefore they're okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Some people call that faith. Isn't that true? That somehow, if there's something not working for me, I've done something wrong. Right? That's not faith, and I was talking about that before, to be seen for oneself. When you know that you want to know something.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that what so many of the fairy tales were told when we're children, you know? The secret garden and all, isn't that the real story about it? Being willing to go where it's not safe to go? Isn't that the hero with a thousand faces?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that over and over again what we know we have to do? We cannot be safe in order to be saved. It's not possible. The I is not savable. But if I is willing to transcend self-clinging, salvation is a given. There's no question. Show me an eye that's going to last. Do you think that's a C-A-T?
Yes.
Don't you dare move.
Okay.
What? They can see how long it takes for that cat to get through the door. Is that reasonable?
Well, it's so helpful. It seems that it's cultural.
Well, to some degree it is, but not really. Not really. To some degree it is, but not at this point. There are no monasteries. But when you are ready, there was, you know, when you actually have the faith, it's amazing what opens to you. As long as it's based on, you know, self-grasping, no matter where you go, it's not going to work. Isn't that what we were talking about the sitting on the cushion and let everybody come, have a cushion for everybody? Because you can sit there on the cushion and be a perfect saint, but, you know, the neighbor honks their horn or something, and suddenly the saint has evaporated and there's this demon there. And then the demon evaporates and there's this dull mind. Oh, I wonder if I should have bought that one or the third one. I could have bought the second one, but then there was the fourth one. Right? So you need cushions for all of them, and every once in a while you remember who you are. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than perfection, develop the ability to watch all the other stories and keep your focus. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you fall asleep, as soon as you wake up, as you're waking up, you try to be aware, and then maybe as soon as you're awake, you say, where did the mind go? And you just ask if you could have a feeling of what it was like to be asleep. And you drop that, and you bring your focus back.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you, you do that, you don't fall asleep very often. Because
mm-hmm.
it's not working. You know, we have lots of ways they call it resistance. Thinking that it's someplace else is the number one resistance, isn't it? There's a better, you know, if the cat was out, it would be better. Isn't that just exactly it?
Mm.
And you let the cat out, and then they're clawing to get in the other side, right? It's only a matter of time, you know. There's always the other side, isn't there? But how to be present and watch that desire for perfection. How to do that. Now that's interesting, because it's so subtle, that point. It's so subtle. It's so subtle. And the minute you fall off, you don't notice, but like 3 minutes later, if you're lucky, you will. Oh, wait a minute, what happened to the plate? And you have to aspire to it, to make it happen. And that means that you develop your faith that you know that there's a way to keep your mind unconnected with subject-object. When you got that faith, clear? Nice question. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Is it aspire to have faith that's unconnected to
subject object?
To keep that as the
subject object,
the guiding.
Yeah. That is about the possibility of attainment for all beings, rather than subject object. If I was somewhere else, I could do the possibility of it. You know?
Oh, yeah.
I would like to see whether I could have the determination strong enough, regardless of what's happening here. I mean, if the ordinary life in Canada causes one to be distracted, you know, where's your faith? You know? What are you going to do when you enter the war zones of your own being?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to quibble about, you know, who did what to whom in your mind. Where's that steadiness when you get to the war zones of actually giving up? Killing or harming when you're sitting in a monastery at night. Outside, and there's a snake there. Where's your calm going to be? It's a good question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have the faith, you're not going to get to that point where you actually believe that the most profound thing one can do is move to a consciousness that is not self-grasping, that has the welfare of all beings. And that is actually transmitted to other people. They actually understand. All beings understand when you care for all beings. And they automatically help you. You can read as many stories as you want, and you see that repeated over and over again. One Tibetan was talking about how his teacher told him that he should go over the mountains to Lhasa and see what was going on there. And of course, he's walking. You know, he's been in this 3-year retreat. He's walking over the mountains. He hasn't been there, like, forever. Young man. And halfway, and he gets to Lhasa and he does what his teacher tells him. And then he's supposed to come back. And he's coming back and he's sort of halfway. And these Chinese... No, he's on his way, and these guards stop him. They say, "Where are you going? Are you a spy? What are you, you know?" They think we're going to throw you in jail, and he's saying, "Well, please do that, because then I would do better to keep meditating than to try to do this for my teacher. It would be more beneficial for me." They decide he's nuts. They say, "Get out of here." They don't take him to jail. They don't torture him. What's their problem? Do you understand what I'm saying? His kindness is like to be able to do something that will benefit all beings. They're not the enemy. Do you think that doesn't communicate? That communicates. But your faith has to be there. Your faith in you being able to sit there and not have any enemies on those other cushions with you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So at least tolerance for those other people in your private triangle. At least tolerance for them. Because, you know, when you're on retreat, those voices, and in an isolated place, those voices can get very loud. If you don't have kindness, it's going to be a war. And I really think there's probably enough warriors. You know, there's a lot of, and there aren't any kind of warriors for peace, not enough of them. But a lot of people who are going to right his might, the world. And right is not the only might. Kindness is a way bigger mighty. It includes, you know, it's like my beloved teacher used to say, go for megalomania for the benefit of all beings. And the accent is not I for the benefit of all beings, but I am not separate than the benefit of all beings. So that Cap's benefit is that we're sitting here being kind to him. I mean, he'll aspire to learn how to work doorknobs. You never know. Some lifetime you probably will. Given enough desire, faith arises. Desire leads to faith. Doesn't it? Do you understand what I said, or are you just nodding because I'm talking about your cat?
I don't understand.
Thank you. Desire,
sure,
leads,
desire leads to faith.
Desire leads to faith. Because desire always creates the reaching beyond the present. And all desire eventually comes to all beings desire happiness, the greatest happiness, is to see things as they are. And the only way to see things as they are is to learn to have faith, slowly, slowly, and not what you think is right, but what is. Is that right? More and more skillful, so the evolution of the tools over lifetimes. And it works with opposing thumb around. Now I can do all kinds of things at once. Hey, wait a minute. Hey, I could turn a rosary too.
What did I do that for?
Desire leads. All beings desire happiness, desire pleasure. Therefore, enlightenment is guaranteed for all beings. So whether you are going to do from the faith point of view, you have the power to know that that is true. All beings desire pleasure. That you know in any way putting yourself greater or lesser than anyone else. Does that make sense? Then when you're sitting somewhere, you know that whatever comes is shared by all beings. There are no enemies. But so long as you're still playing politics, you still don't believe that. Right? Yeah.
Is that then connected to the guru yoga and
yep.
In the prayer it says something about forgive me for, like, the inexpiable sins and all those things. So does that mean that everybody, like, that I have committed in some time or other all those bad things that are listed there?
Whoever made you over lifetimes, you know, which one of your ancestors, you know, how far back do you want to go?
Is that the idea that if you go back into the ancestors and all those...
It could be one of the ideas. There are many ideas, maybe, in your own brain. There is the nurturing of the idea of murder, which, you know, if you get just a little bit, you know, just a little less cognizant one day, half asleep, you might swing out and kill somebody, and in your dream it will be, you know, who knows?
Okay, so that's not necessarily the interpretation of that.
I'm saying it's worth exploring. I'm saying don't look for a right answer. What does it mean to you, and does that change? Isn't that entirely dissatisfactory? I hope.
Well, I'm always looking for the right answer. So.
Yeah, me too. And sometimes I do it in my bathroom mirror with myself, and I still don't give myself a right answer. Damn. Uh-oh, 7 minutes after cat let loose time. Getting on the phone to the union. So, whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. So there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. So there is less suffering.
Thank you for your great compassion.
There's a couple of nice things in this book, eh?
Mm-hmm.